Hello, my name is Simon Ward, and I would like to welcome you to the Triathlon Coach podcast. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic champions and covering all distances from sprint to Ironman. Now it's my goal in this weekly 30-minute podcast to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. So as I've already said, we've got just 30 minutes, so let's get rolling with today's guest. Hello listeners and welcome back. And today I have a different sort of podcast. I'm joined by one of the athletes that I work with, Matt Lawrence. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks very much for having me, Simon. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, great to have you on the show, Matt. And today I wanted to talk about an extraordinary achievement you've just had in the last few weeks, which was qualifying for the Hawaii Ironman World Championships, which is coming up for you. It'll be 12 months because, as we know, for listeners here, the Hawaii Ironman Championships 2018 have just finished. So you've got 12 months to prepare. But what I really wanted to chat about and sort of help the listeners understand is the journey for an athlete who actually qualifies, what it takes, you know, mentally, physically, in terms of organization, family, everything that's gone into the mix that finally helped you to get across the line this year. So let's just touch on that briefly. You qualified back in September at Ironman Wales, is that correct?
Yeah, that was correct, yeah.
Just briefly tell us about your day, and we'll come back to it later, but briefly tell us about your day and how it went.
I suppose you'll be familiar with the conversations we had in the lead up to the day. I was at the stage where I was having a bit of a mental wobble, thinking to myself, well, if I don't get there this time, then geez, what's the point? And we had a long chat about that. And over the next few days before the lead into the race, I think I expressed to you that I sensed a feeling of calm. People who do Ironman will know, you know, the night before the race, you tend not to sleep very well. But I slept like a baby, and everything just seemed to be falling okay. And so on the day, I went just around the corner from the hotel, did the usual, put the Garmin on the bike, put the nutrition on the bike, and then went back to the hotel room and just plodded around for a bit of time, and eventually joined the melee on the way down to the swim start. And it was a different type of swim start this year, so we had a lot more challenges getting through the tiny streets of Tenby. So I nearly missed the front sort of wave, which I was aiming for. I had to kind of scoot around the edges, but thankfully managed to find my way behind some other like-minded athletes, so away from the sort of the athlete chute and down the pedestrian side, and got my position on the start line. And from there, it just sort of unfolded. I had a pretty good swim. I was happy on the Aussie exit to see that I was on course for sort of 56 minutes, and didn't really feel like it was the usual fist fight that we all go through. Anyone who's familiar with Tenby will know the 1 kilometer run, which was just spectacular this year. I mean, it was like being in your own auditorium or your own sort of noise funnel, and trying not to let that get to me and get carried away. Jumped on the bike and it was pretty peaceful. There weren't many people on the road when I was on the road until the second lap, and I had a set power that I was working to. And on the day, I thought to myself during the bike session, I thought about the conversation we'd had about sometimes, you know, you need to take a bit of a risk. And I looked at the power meter and I thought about how I felt, and I sort of went a bit based on feel and took that little bit of a risk and had a great bike ride, which held me, you know, to a good stead until about halfway in the marathon. And halfway, Julie, my wife, was sort of pointing me out the splits at the side, and we were talking about how it was, how I needed to know where fifth place was, because I knew there'd be about five spots in the age group, and I was sitting in third at the time. And then about half marathon, you know, the wheels just sort of started to fall off, and I bumped into a fellow athlete, Dan, who we had a long lap together. And then from there, I got to a point where I wanted to walk, and I'd probably walked for about 100 metres and then sort of beat myself up thinking, I've never been this close. I've been close before, and I'm sure we'll touch on that. But, you know, the 60 seconds I spent walking was it felt like 60 minutes. And I eventually got myself back up to a slight canter, and I jumped on this guy from, I think it was Malden Tri, on the way down the hill in Wales. I jumped on this guy's heels and I said to him, it's quite a nice story actually, I said to him, you set a nice tempo, pal, you know, maybe I'll just stick with you. And he was on his second lap, I think, and I was on my last. And then we split at the, you know, I went down the finishing chute, he wished me good luck and he went his way. And I looked him up on social media afterwards and just said that those last 3Ks with him were, you know, were really important. And he told me it was his first Ironman, and he took a lot of confidence from me saying to him that he was setting a nice tempo. And yeah, it was a nice finish to the day, really. So yeah, it was just an unbelievable day. I still haven't really got my head around it.
Okay, well, we can come back to that later and maybe finish off the whole conversation with you know, finally coming across the line, the emotions there, seeing the time, and then having to wait 12 hours before you finally knew. But let's go right back to the beginning then. So what year did you do your very first triathlon? Can you remember?
Yeah, so the very first triathlon would have been in 2006. That wasn't an Ironman. It was it was a local sprint, actually. But I'd signed up to Ironman Canada when it used to be held in Penticton for the year 2006. So yeah, I'd pretty much thrown myself in the deep end with a sprint triathlon with my first one. And then within the next 8 months, I knew I had an Ironman on the cards.
Okay, now, prior to, because I know that you're a very, very powerful cyclist, and a lot of that's down to the spin classes you used to do regularly in as part of your job. But what was your athletic history prior to your first triathlon? Did you come from a swim background? Were you a runner? Or did you just keep fit like a lot of people?
Well, no, really. To be honest with you, Simon, I didn't really have a specific sporting background. I mean, I was a West Country boy when I was growing up. So, yeah, I mean, the main things to focus on were rugby at school, and sometimes there was a bit of track work in the summer. But for the most part, you know, and up until I was about early 20s, I was just involved on the rugby pitch and playing sort of team games, but at no particular level, just more for, you know, more for the school or local teams, and that was it, really. But like you say, you know, I think about 2000, 2001, I changed my career to being a personal trainer, and alongside that came about 5 to 6 hours of indoor cycling classes a week, which I suppose was my first foray into any kind of endurance sport.
So you mentioned right at the start there that you swam 56 minutes in Wales, which is a pretty good time. It's a sea swim. It's two laps. The sea can be unpredictable there. And one would sort of assume that somebody who can swim 56 minutes has a background of swimming. But what I've taken from your previous sentence was that you didn't really have a swim background. I guess you must have started when you decided you were going to do your first triathlon, did you?
Absolutely, yeah. She should take the credit, I suppose. But I mean, as soon as I jumped into the idea of I'm going to do triathlon, I joined the local tri club, Crystal Palace here, and I started attending their sessions. And to be quite frank, I was like a bit of a wet flannel in the swim. You know, I couldn't really swim. I could swim for the sake of keeping me alive, but you know, when it came to actually swimming laps, I was, you know, I started off in the slow lane. And I suppose the credit really goes to and you know, Julie, my wife, but she used to be a swim coach and a lifeguard back in Penticton when she was younger. And, you know, she spent some time with me and, you know, taught me all the sort of little things that I needed to know. And then got quite angry with me when I started moving up the lanes quicker than she did.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is particularly important for those people who are listening and thinking, well, you know, you've got to be a really good swimmer to put yourself in with a shout of having a good Ironman finish. You didn't. And a lot of the people who finishing in the top 10 in races generally come from a swim background, so you didn't. So let's be clear about that. You didn't. Your wife taught you to swim in order to compete, not to save your life. And from there, you took to it fairly quickly, and clearly you have some sort of affinity with water if you're able to swim the way you do now.
Yeah, I guess that's a fair statement. I don't really think I've done anything particularly special. I suppose just practice. You know, I've obviously worked with yourself, and you know, I've stuck to the basic rules of making sure I refine the stroke and look at the drills. But I don't think I've done anything particularly special. Like you say, maybe as a, you know, I'm just a little bit more comfortable in the water. But yeah, it's certainly not a weakness of mine, the swim, which I know a lot of people really struggle with, and I've never really had a an issue with the, you know, the open water panic, anxiety, or, you know, lots of people around. That's just something that's never really been an issue for me. I suppose that's from my early years in rugby, you know, where you'd be placed second row in the scrum and, you know, really you just bunched in and you got your head between two other guys' hips. So I'm quite used to being in that tight situation, but certainly swimming's not my natural background.
That rugby background certainly helps in the start of the swim as well, doesn't it? Just having to fight for a bit of space.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a good old rock and roll. It's just how we like it back in the West Country for sure.
Okay, so jumping in at the deep end, literally. Ironman Canada was my first Ironman a few years before you did yours. But it was, for those people who've never been to that part of Canada, in British Columbia, Penticton's a lovely place. I highly recommend it. Ironman Canada, your wife's family were from that locality, so nice for you to go across for a family holiday. How did you fare at your first Ironman? And I'm sure everybody will want to know, because, you know, we know how important it is to have a time. So how did you fare and what was your time?
Well, I don't really think I went into it with any sense of time. In fact, the feeling was not dissimilar, I suppose, to the feeling that I'm getting now thinking ahead to Kona, which is I just need to finish. You know, that was the main goal at the time. And I really, you know, I'd been watching, my father-in-law had an old Ironman Canada medal that he picked up from somewhere on the street from years gone by that somebody just left lying around. And I've been looking at that for years since I've been going over there. And I just wanted that medal. So, you know, my lead up to it would have been probably, you know, as most people would have, you know, I tried to fit some training in around work. You know, it wasn't necessarily structured. I know I hadn't been working with a coach at that time, so it was all just attending the local tri club sessions, which were, you know, which were geared to, I suppose, a multitude of different types of distances and athletes. So, yeah, I mean, I just built up some level of fitness, did the long rides, probably didn't do anything more than a half marathon, if I remember rightly. And on the day leading up to it, I set out some time goals that I thought were realistic, and not knowing what I was capable of. And yeah, it was the most amazing but most unpleasant experience I think I can remember from the last 20 years of my life in terms of the mix of the two. And yeah, I'd set myself out. I think I'd set myself a goal of 12 hours 30 or something like that. And from memory, I think I did about 12:19. But I do remember that I did what I did in the early days. You mentioned my cycling background. You know, I swam pretty well. Got out on the bike, had no idea what to do in terms of pacing, got my head down. You know, I think I first Ironman bike ride, I think I hit a 5:30 in Penticton, and then sort of walked my way to a 5-hour 9 marathon or something like that.
So here's an interesting comparison then, because the course stayed exactly the same throughout the year, apart from that one year, the aberration when they had the forest fires. But in the main, it was a one-lap swim, a one-lap bike course with two big climbs, and then a run which went down the lake to the far end and back again, so just one lap. So you and I would have competed on the same course 11 years apart. My first race there was 11 hours 20. I think I probably cycled around a 5:30, which meant my marathon must have been a little faster than yours and probably swim probably about the same. And so you've gone on 12 years later to qualify for Kona by coming fifth in your age group. I never managed to get any faster on an Ironman than 10 hours 40. I did a 10:18 at a non-WTC event. So an interesting comparison there in progress, in what's possible, in the fact that starting point doesn't often bear any resemblance to what you're capable of. And we can talk about that journey now then. So you and I met in 2007. I can't rightly remember what the catalyst was for you joining me, but I guess it must have been to build on your Ironman performance. Maybe you can remember.
Yeah, I do actually, because it was back in the days when we had a desktop PC in the lounge rather than laptops and iPads. That's how long ago it feels. But I was just sitting down after Canada, and I'd done the usual, I'm not doing one of those again. And then probably within the next sort of week, I was straight away signing up to Canada again. So I thought, well, how can I improve myself? And I looked for triathlon coaches, and there you were, just on the screen in front of me. And I think that's kind of how it started.
So that gives us 11 years together, really, doesn't it? Some people don't even get that far in a marriage.
No, that's true. we haven't threatened divorce, I don't think, but
We've had a little separation, haven't we? So we can come back to that one a bit later on. We could call it a trial separation. We're back together now and everything's rosy. At what point did you start to think that, firstly, that you'd like to go and compete in Kona in Hawaii? And then, if it was at a different time, at what point did you think it might actually be possible to qualify?
That's a good question. I think we all sit there and watch the coverage. It's coming up in the next 2 weeks, isn't it, for this year? And I think there's hundreds and thousands of us out there that sit and watch the coverage, and we enjoy it as a sport, and we enjoy the spectacle of watching the pros and seeing the races unfold. But I suppose, you know, getting there and the difference between watching and enjoying it and actually thinking I could get there was a long sort of stretch. You know, we're talking in 2006, 2007, I was enjoying the viewing aspect and being part of the tribe, if you like. And it didn't really start to feel like I was ever going to get to the hallowed turf of Hawaii, I suppose, until I want to say 2010, 2011. I think 2008 was Penticton, and I think I got my first sub 11 hour, something around there. And then about 2010, 2011, I think yourself and myself, and there are a few of us, I think, they're out in Lanzarote. And I remember distinctly that my weakness has always been a run. I've got the cyclist legs, so I remember distinctly that I was on the island of Lanzarote, and I think you'd had to pull out because you injured yourself on a run.
Yeah, that was when I ruptured my ankle ligaments.
That was it.
Yeah,
and so you'd gone out and you decided to just stand on the side and shout abuse at us, which was obviously appreciated.
I think you'll find that it was good natured encouragement, Matt. It just in your exhausted haze, it sounded like abuse.
At the time, that's what it was. But there was one thing that happened there, and you know, that was the, you know, that was the first time I'd actually managed to run most of the marathon and get under 4 hours. And you know, it's still a long way away from what needed to be done. But all of a sudden, I'd gone 10:28 in Lanzarote with your good-natured encouragement, of course, Simon. And so, you know, then we moved into 2012, and I started having thoughts about whether I could qualify. And when we put together quite a plan that year. And 2012 was the last year that Ironman was going to be in Penticton. So it felt like, you know, it felt like the time to really go for it. It was, I think, over 3,000 athletes in the race. And we put together a heck of a plan. And that was the first year that I really, truly thought I could qualify. Obviously, it didn't come to fruition. For the reasons that you and I know about, particularly, you know, the number of people that were there versus the number of percentage allocation of spots. But yeah, it, you know, to be, I think on that year was about 60 seconds away. That was when it really came to life.
So let's go back then, just a little bit. That Lanzarote performance, 10 hours 20. You can't have been far away from a qualification spot there. By memory, in that age group, you know, 10 hours was usually somewhere around what you needed to do, even still is now.
Yeah, I think we've got a few friends that have been to Lanzarote. It's just it's a tough race, isn't it? You know, and it brings a lot of fast guys there. So, you know, I think, I can't remember, but I think 10 at the time, the 10:20 something, you know, was good enough for in the 20s in the age group. But, you know, looking at the times to go around, I think you said that the times in your age group, I think, are ridiculously smoking fast. So it's a challenging place to qualify. It wasn't a million miles away, but again, it felt like that, looking at the times that were there and what I'd done.
Yeah, and Lanzarote suited you, really. You're a strong swimmer, and it's a sea swim there, although it's not usually that. It's usually reasonably calm in the morning. But the bike can be, you know, it can be very windy, and there are three significant hills that everybody thinks of, plus some other ones in between that most people forget about, which tend to sap your leg strength. So you've got to be a strong cyclist there. Do you think that was a course that played to your strengths then?
Yeah, I've not done as many courses as people might actually think. You know, I've been quite consistently going to Penticton and Wales and Lanzarote, and I've been to Austria once, but I've always favoured the more challenging bike courses, being a cyclist, and gives me a better shout on the run if people's legs are a little bit more tired. So yeah, I mean, Lanzarote was obviously great. The heat was something that I didn't really struggle with as much as some people, but the bike course is it's wicked. I think they changed it this year and I've heard it's even worse, so I guess maybe I'll have to go back and experience that at some point in the future.
Yeah, I think they've had to change because of necessity due to traffic congestion on the island and allowing people access to the airport. There are certain iconic bits that are missed out, and there's a nasty little out and back that again saps your legs, adds a bit more climbing in.
I don't know if they ever took out the death road, the road of death, you know, that horrible road. I don't know if they've taken that out, but that was always the worst bit for me. Hated that bit.
Yeah, I found that the way to get over that mentally was to go and do the Paris-Roubaix Sportif a couple of months before and spend 55k riding over rough cobbles. And after that, nothing ever seems quite as bad.
Yeah, no, I bet it doesn't. Good point. I'll stick that one in the notebook.
In fact, I do remember that we did that before the last time. I think 2014 I did Ironman Lanzarote last, and we did do the Paris-Roubaix Sportif that year. And as we were riding down that road of death, which if anyone knows Ironman Lanzarote, it's a sort of a 3 or 4K section that cuts out the town of Teguise. And I can remember just riding along there in a big gear, as I'd learnt to do in Roubaix, and just laughing all the way along and thinking how many people were hating it. And me, I was probably the only one that was enjoying the moment. Anyway, we digress. Let's go back to Ironman Canada 2012, because you mentioned there that we put together a robust plan, and we spent a fair amount of time. You'd obviously got a fair amount of experience in learning the course and knowing how to pace the course and how to ride it and where you could go hard and what the local weather conditions were like. And we looked at the results from previous years, and I think we estimated that if you could do a 9:45, that would get you into the top 10. And there were always plenty of spots available in Canada, weren't there? Because I think this was at a time when there still weren't a huge amount of qualification races, and Canada being one of the historical events that had been around for a long time, still had 100 slots. And so on previous history, we'd gone on the basis that 9:45 would put you there or thereabouts and probably get you a slot. And I think from memory, you actually paced it perfectly, certainly in terms of crossing the line in the right time, and weren't far away from a 9:45, were you?
Yeah. Do you know what? I suppose this is a really key transitional point in my Ironman career, if you like. This is the first time we actually put some strategy and some, I suppose, sort of calculations behind actually the race on the day, which normally we hadn't done before. You know, I'd certainly just got in with an idea of time, but I hadn't really done the homework. And certainly in this case, I'd started sitting down and looking at where the locations of the drink stops were, which ones I'd be using, which ones I wouldn't, based upon, you know, would I be climbing? Because I didn't want to add any extra ballast to the bike. So I strategically started thinking about things like that. And as you say, you know, looking at the previous results, I started trying to pencil together what sort of time would be needed to get me in that ballpark. And as you rightly said, you know, we were looking at, I think the time there was going to be something like five age group slots based on history. So we're looking at a 9:45 to give me a good chance of getting I think it was the top five at the time. And we put together the plan, if you like. And on the day, despite the result, and I'm sure we'll talk a bit about the disappointment that happened afterwards, but actually, in terms of execution, it couldn't have gone any better. The only thing that happened that, you know, on that day I still look back to and think, was that the bit that cost me? Was I had a moment on the out and back section down near Karamios where my chain got dropped and got sucked into the front neck, if you like, and that caused me to have to get off and untangle it, which maybe cost me about 90 seconds at the time. Was just frustration, but looking back, it was quite it was quite relevant to the actual result. But yeah, I think it was a 9:49 I crossed in. So first time under 10 hours and got in under 9:50 as well. So really stoked with that on the bigger picture. But obviously the roll down sort of slot allocation and stuff the next day was less than perfect.
Yeah, you did. But how many places did you miss it by, or what? How many minutes did you miss it by? It wasn't much, was it?
It was what I was sixth in age group. I believe, including the pro field and everybody, I was 49th overall, but sixth in age group, and there were five slots, and I missed it by just over 60 seconds.
Now, I mean, that's a huge disappointment. You mentioned that there, and we can talk about that in just a second. That's a huge disappointment, and as a coach, I've experienced this with and observed this happening to other athletes, and those that have wanted to qualify for Kona and set everything up in that year to get a performance that would get them there, and done exactly what you and I did, you know, looked at the course in micro detail, worked out where the aid stations were, worked out about how long it's going to take to get between water stations, and really did you need to carry that extra bottle? Could you save a kilo here? You know, talking about Canada in particular, the bit that you mentioned, the Canada course was basically going south down a valley with a tailwind, over a long climb, and then north on the other in a valley on a parallel to the one you start off in, going north into a headwind, another big climb to get over the mountain range, and then descending back into Penticton. And knowing where the wind is and how you have to work harder in the afternoon and you have to go a bit easier in the morning. We talked about all of those things and put together a plan. So that's a key point for anybody who wants to get to Kona. It's not just about doing the training and feeling fit. You've got to go that, but there's got to be some attention to detail there. But then, you know, it's not a smooth path. You had this huge disappointment that you were the next man to walk up to the stage and claim your spot. And unfortunately, there was a guy there that went before you, and you did exactly what we planned. You hit everything perfectly. You couldn't have done any better on the day, maybe or maybe not with the mechanical, but yet you didn't quite make it. And you could have quite easily just turned your back on the sport then with that disappointment and not gone back, couldn't you? So I think
we joked a bit about retirement. I think I may have mentioned that, and I think you maybe gave me some more good natured advice about that. But yeah, I do remember saying, I think maybe I'll just stick to something shorter. You know, I remember that.
But that there will be lots of people who are racing in Kona this year, will be racing in Kona next year, who've suffered similar disappointments. And I think it's another key lesson is that there has to be some mental resilience in order to overcome these disappointments and also overcome some of the hurdles that one faces in life. So is there anything you mentioned about the disappointment then and what happened in the following days? Is there anything else you want to just talk about to expand on that, or should we move on to what happened after 2012?
Well, no. I mean, I think 2012 was just at the time was disappointing. I'd thrown everything at it, and we'll probably get to that in a bit. But no, there was, I suppose that was, that was a key moment. That's what I'd say. It was a key moment. We'd undergone some hardships in the years before, with the loss of a child, which I don't mind mentioning. I know you know all about it. And, it'd been a 2-year journey back from that moment, where I suppose I was in my deepest, darkest place. And then I got to this point where actually I'd maybe started to come out of that and start to think about doing sort of more positive things. And yeah, it was a bit of a punch in the gut, I won't lie. But no, I mean, the next few years, that's even more interesting. And certainly, you know, the last 18 months are probably the bit that that are most resonant to most people.
Okay, well, let's not spoil the surprise on that one. Let's just rewind. It was 2010 was sort of a very emotional time for you and Julie. You mentioned about the loss of a child. You know, triathlon was clearly a really important part of your life, but at that point, you know, other things occupied your mind. And how did triathlon fit in at that point there? Was it an opportunity for you to release a bit of stress, or did you not give a monkeys about riding your bike or running?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, in the acute phases, you know, like any bereavement for anybody, whether it's a parent or a child or whoever it is, you know, the first thing turns to, you know, that sense of pain, and everything else goes by the wayside. But certainly prior to finding out that we'd lost our daughter, we had booked to go to Lanzarote. I think it was 2010. And I was, you know, so I was sort of, up until that point, I was training or getting ready to train for that. And we were going to take this family holiday, first time we were going to go as parents. And yeah, as soon as that happened, obviously everything went out the window. And, I don't remember our conversations during that time. You know, it was a bit of a blur, but certainly, you know, the race was still booked and paid for. And Julie and I went out together, and I tried to do some training, but clearly my mind wasn't on it. And I remember this is the, it was a DNF. I got, you know, I just didn't have the heart to do it. I was there. I was supposed to be there with my, you know, my daughter and my wife. And, I got off the bike and I think I'd done 10K, and I just pulled up to her and I said, I just can't, it's not for me, you know, I'm done. And I pulled out on the day, and, Yeah, and just I didn't have the drive on that particular day, and I immediately regretted it, you know, in the next 24 hours, because I felt like I'd, you know, not honoured what we were going to do on that day, or, and for various different reasons. But certainly that was a, you know, that was probably the less or the least amount of time that I ever cared about triathlon. I won't lie about that.
The sort of emotional struggles you had then, and dealing with pain in different parts of your life, does that help when you're doing a triathlon now? Did it help you 2 years later in Canada? Did it help you in Wales a few weeks ago?
You know, that's a really well placed question, actually, because I suppose that would constitute as the biggest amount of pain, emotional, physical, whatever, that I suppose I've ever experienced in my life, and that is now a massive source of strength. The times that I've, you know, I think you'll remember I did a 60 mile treadmill run shortly after that to raise money, and you know, all the times that you go through when you're physically in pain, or you're out training, or you know, you think you're going to quit now, I just think about those moments, and you know how tough it was for Julie and I, and how strong we had to be, and yeah, nothing will ever be as painful as that particular day. So yeah, it's a huge source of strength. Obviously, you know, it's a time in my life that I wish hadn't happened that way, but you know, there is a silver lining, if you like, in that respect.
Okay, so 2012, we've got over the disappointment. I can't rightly remember again what Ironman events you had after that. I think, did you go back to Canada, or did you start switching your focus to Ironman Wales then?
No, I think I goofed around in 2013 on the back of the disappointment, saying, "Oh well, I'm just gonna, you know, I'm gonna take it down a notch. I've done everything I can. I've thrown everything I can at it, and you know, there's no point trying any harder, is there? Let's do some 70.3 training." And I think we went out to Mallorca that year. That's right, isn't it? 2013.
Yep, I think so. Yeah,
and so we went out to Mallorca that year, and we raced there, and I probably did some other events. I can't even remember what they were, and then I think I came to you with this glorified idea that I think Canada had moved then to Whistler, and so I think Mike Brown Events in Canada had decided, or had managed to get the license for Challenge, so they launched the Challenge Penticton race in 2014. So I think I came to you with this harebrained advice. Or idea, sorry. That's you know what? Why don't I go and race in the pro ranks? I remember doing that.
I can remember that. Yeah, I can remember that now. Yeah, yeah.
So I was looking. I think at the time I was saying to you, you know, yeah, you know, there's no Kona slots there, but you know, I need to have a challenge. I can't just go along and complete the race, because you know, for me, that's not incentivizing. I want to go and race some of the big boys and you know, just see how I get on. And you know, quite obviously, I got schooled on the day. You know, but it was a great experience, that 2014 challenge race. Kudos and hats off to the guys that race in the pro field, and the ladies, because it's a totally different form of racing, and that was just an interesting experience all round, and it was an experience, it certainly wasn't a result.
Where was the Canada performance when you absolutely hammered it on the bike, went way too hard and suffered? Was that race?
That would have been that race, yeah, because I got sucked into, I think I got out of the water in the third pack of the men's pros, and I got sucked into a bit of a bike race, and especially around, I think, as you mentioned, the out and back section, and then up the Yellow Lake, the last big climb before the descent into town. There was a chap who some might know. He's a New Zealand guy. He did fairly well at Bolton recently, called Simon Cochrane, and he was I think he was third overall on the year, but we hooked up and decided to do a bit of work together to drop the other guys, and I ended up riding a 4:51, which, you know, would have been 40 minutes quicker than I'd ever ridden that course. I was still in good shape, but and then I had Otolo, I think, probably about a week later, didn't I? So on the marathon, I suffered, and you know, I still think I ran a 3:40 something, but a lot of that was down to, I knew I was racing again the week later in a marquee event in the Island to Islands, and you know, I could I gone faster, I don't know, it was a heck of a different experience. It wasn't racing yourself, it was surging and playing and mind games. It was a great time.
But all valuable lessons if you care to learn from them.
Yeah, and you know what I did, actually, because you know, I got quite aware of, you know, going, getting a bit more scientific, and I'm quite an analytical kind of kind of athlete, I suppose. I like to look at the numbers, and you and I have had fair discussions about chronic training load and bits and pieces. But certainly there was my first understanding of, you know, what average power was versus normalized power and variability index. And it was quite clear to me that, you know, I'd ridden not the most amazing power, but the variability index and the surges and normalized power was just off the charts, because I was going with these guys off the front all the time and responding to attacks. And yeah, that was quite a valuable lesson. I learned quite quickly that you don't get a good marathon time off of going hard, going steady, going hard, going steady.
But interesting that the way that the Ironman Wales course is laid out, you can't help but go hard, go steady, just to the topography. So maybe a lesson there in learning how to control things as much as possible when still having to deal with the challenges of the course.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. The climbs don't help that, but yeah, you need to and scale back your perceived exertion or your expectations on, you know, particularly the challenging bike courses if you want to have a good marathon afterwards.
All right. So you mentioned that you've had more challenges since then. So 2016, you started to get some odd read. Was it 2016 or early 2017? You started to get some odd readings on your Garmin, I think, and we had some discussions and decided that it was just the equipment playing up and there was nothing wrong with you, because obviously you're an Ironman, so why would there be? So you did what everybody else did. You blamed the Garmin. I think you changed the heart rate strap, threw the thing in the bin, got another one, and that didn't change things. So tell everybody what happened around that and then subsequently.
So yeah, that was post 2016. Another very close call in Ironman Wales of Kona spots, and coming off the back of that, you know, the usual 6 weeks downtime and get back into training for an assault on 2017. And like you say, you know, I was getting all these interesting readings. What I was finding was that no matter what I did in terms of intensity, my heart rate would not reflect what I knew as an experienced athlete, what my exertion levels were. So there was definitely a disconnect, heart rate and what I expected to see. And it was made really clear when, and I mean this, I hope she doesn't hear this, but I mean this respectfully to Julie, but when I went out for a run with Julie, you know, just a like long, steady run, my heart rates were getting readings that I'd be doing more in sort of tempo sessions, you know, and it, for me, it would have been quite an easy session. So, you know, I'd spoken to Carmen, and she's, you know, Julie still says I should drop them a line and say they probably saved my life in some ways, but I maybe need to thank their equipment for that, even though at the time I was saying it was useless and broken. And I spoke to them on the phone about software and various stuff, and they couldn't understand what was going on. And I suppose at some point, I don't know who or whether it was myself convinced me, but I was going for a routine appointment with the doctor, repeat medication or something. And I asked if I could get an ECG, and he booked me in for, you know, a couple of days later that week. And, you know, that I'd been out to a meeting in the morning. I was feeling fine, went to the ECG. And I don't know if you've ever sort of experienced this, but I was expecting to, you know, to just walk in, get strapped up and get told, yeah, we're not sure. Not in my wildest dreams did I think that, you know, I was going to lie there, that the nurse was going to be on the phone to a cardiologist, I guess, somewhere remotely, who was interpreting the results, and for her to turn around and say, you need to go to A&E, love. Would you like me to call you an ambulance? And, you know, I've been, that was not what I was expecting to hear. And obviously, you know, I tried to deal with that with a bit of laughter, but obviously it was quite a shocking moment.
I've not experienced that personally, as in my own symptoms. However, Fiona, my partner, experienced something very similar. We came back from volunteering at a race, and she was having some quite high heart rate experiences. You know, feeling like she was getting palpitations. It was a Sunday morning, and In true Fiona style, she just laughed it off and said, I'll be fine, because, of course, I am an Iron Man, just like those little mm-hmm. extra normal cartoons. Why would I have heart problems? I've done Iron Man and I've been to Hawaii. So I took Fiona to the doctors on the Monday afternoon, and he took one look at her and her heart rate and said, if you can't drive down to A&E, I can call you an ambulance, but you need to go there immediately. So we had the same thing, and when we took her down there, they took us straight into A&E and then whistled us straight up to the cardiac you know, the heart ward, and kept her in for 5 days. So yes, I have experienced that, and it's definitely something that just because you're an endurance athlete, you shouldn't be ignoring. And in fact, if anyone's listening and thinks they have issues with the heart, I would suggest that the most sensible thing to do is actually to get it checked out, because being an extreme endurance athlete might make you a little bit more susceptible to this sort of thing. But that's for another story. And you mentioned medication there, Matt, because there's one thing I'd forgotten, was that you'd had a health issue before this heart problem, hadn't you, with your thyroid?
Yeah, for you know, there's no history or of any sort of thyroid issues within my family. And I obviously exhibited some symptoms that, again, didn't fit with how I was used to feeling. I was lethargic and kept getting fevers, and that got checked out through blood tests, and I got diagnosed as hypothyroid, so yeah, low thyroid function, and basically placed on thyroxine for the remainder of my life, which did stabilize the hormones in the body and allowed me to feel like myself again and train and go to work, and you know, it stopped almost immediately all the sort of the fever-like symptoms that I kept getting stopped. So yes, that was another sort of short bump in the road of what goes on. I have no idea what caused that, or whether that was just something that was destined to be. But again, I'm not unique in that way. I'm sure there's plenty of people that have various things wrong with them that you know they have to overcome.
Well, interesting. You know, it's just goes to show that the life of an endurance athlete isn't, as you say, it's not always plain sailing, and there are challenges of which you've overcome several. So let's go back to talking about your heart issue then. So you discovered and been shocked to find out that actually you're not a perfect specimen, and you've got to go to the cardiology ward. So was this early 2017?
It was early 2017. I don't think I ever felt I was a perfect specimen, but it was rightly, you know, it wasn't what you expect as an athlete, as an endurance athlete. And I went to this cardiac ward in 2017, and I was told what the problem was. So just to clarify for the people that are listening here, so I'm no doctor, but the way I understand it, so I had an arrhythmia. It was called an atrial flutter. So in principle, that the atrial chambers were fluttering, if you like, rather than contracting on a regular beat. So that blood wasn't clearing fully to the ventricles, the lower chambers, and so I wasn't getting a very efficient heartbeat. Equally, there was the potential that, you know, that some of the blood that wasn't being cleared could clot, which could then lead to things like stroke. So all of these words were being bandied around, which really didn't put me at ease. But I was told that there's no training, you're not doing that, and we need to get this fixed. And so we discussed the options to try and get it fixed. But it felt like a long time between the initial diagnosis and the actual correction of the problem.
Yeah, it was a good 6 months, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah. I mean, I tried going through sort of private way as well, through my work, private medical insurance, but eventually the NHS came up trumps, and I got into King's College, who, I've got a fantastic group of doctors and specialists, and I felt really comfortable and at ease with them. They were fantastic.
You were working with Sanjay Sharma, weren't you? Professor Sharma?
Yeah, post catheter ablation and the fix, etc. I mean, the cardiologists on discharge, general cardiologists, and I mean this with no disrespect to somebody in a hospital who does this, they're fantastic. But I suppose for the likes of us in the Ironman community and ultra endurance athletes, we don't fit the norm. We have lower heart rates, or we're just not normal. That's probably a good expression to use. And so they looked at what my heart rate was doing after that, and there were some other things going on in terms of the way my heart was working. And they sort of went with you should just give up Ironman. You can't do this anymore. And I wasn't really satisfied with that. And I think I had a conversation with you saying I'd really like to see somebody who's a specialist in the field of endurance athletes or athletics and ask them their opinion. And you put me onto Sanjay Sharma over at St. George's. We had a very different conversation that day, which was sort of the catalyst towards 2018.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. So earlier we mentioned that our marriage, which has lasted 11 years, had a trial separation. So I, as a concerned coach, I did my best to stay in touch and sort of mollify some of your moods, if you like, which I can totally understand, you know, not being able to train and sort of having this thing hanging over. And I have to say, I'd expected that you would, once you started training again, you'd be joining the squad, but you decided that we were going to have a bit of a trial separation, didn't you? Not wanting to put you on the spot or anything, but why was that, Matt?
This airing your dirty laundry in public.
It's fine because it's all part of the mix, and if you're happy to talk about it, it'll give. It's another thing that I think that we find with triathletes is that and most things, it's easy to think that the grass is greener somewhere else.
I would say, yeah. The reasoning behind it is that I'd come out of 2017, obviously, and up until that point, and I just felt like. Go back to the Sanjay Sharma conversation. I asked him very, very openly, you know, what's going to happen? And he said, well, it may well come back. It could be 2 years. It could be 10. It could be 20. I just don't know. But, you know, you've probably got some time. And I said, could I achieve some of my bucket list items, thinking of things like Kona? And he said, oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, so I went into 2018 with this is it. This is, you know, I've got limited shelf life. I need to make a difference and it needs to happen now. And, you know, that started with obviously a mindset, but it also started with maybe I need to change the way I'm training. And maybe for that reason, I need to change the person who's coaching me. And that was the catalyst for that. That was the reason behind, okay, I need to make some changes. So that's what happened. And like you said, you know, you try just based upon the fact that you think that there's going to be something better. You know, there was fantastic training on the other side, but it just wasn't for me. I struggled with the format, and I suppose the most important thing that I want to convey to the people that listen is that I suppose a good coach, it's not about what's, you know, being put down on Training Peaks or put down on the paper. It's about that person understanding you as an individual and how you can get the most out of the training in the limited time that you have. And because we had 11 years together, like you say, you know, you understood my lifestyle, you knew what my work was, you knew that I worked shift patterns, you obviously knew a lot about my family. And that was hugely beneficial in the way we structured the training, because you had so much more knowledge than just some, you know, just some coach on the end of the telephone who didn't know me as an individual. So yeah, it was a short-sighted change at the time, and one that I thought was going to be the key difference. But I quickly learned that actually it was very, very challenging to be able to do what I needed to do without having the benefits of somebody who knew me and knew my you know, my ways of working and my family. So the grass felt greener, and obviously within a few months I was you know, knocking at your door asking if I could come home.
And as we know, the rest is history.
Indeed.
It sounds like a love affair, doesn't it? They can make a film about this. but for me, there's a couple of important things there. You know, we've talked about the fact that we go back to 2007, which is 11 years now. So that and you mentioned there that there's a relationship, there's an understanding, there's a trust. And I think that's something that's really important in all coaching relationships, regardless of whether it's sport or business, or music or whatever, is trusting the judgment and of the coach and, you know, that sort of relationship. And the other thing is, as we know, is triathletes are always looking for shiny new things. And that comes to, that's equipment. That's also training methods. And that can often be a coach's, thinking that the coach is the one that's holding you back, and that if you try something else, that will be better. But it's not always better. It may be different, but it doesn't mean it's better. In fact, it might be a different approach to achieving the same result. And sometimes it is better to stick with what you know. And if you take a look at the successful athletes in many sports, you will find that they have long lasting relationships with the coaches that they work with, and I think that's an important point for anybody who wants to go to Kona and has a coach is find somebody you can trust and work with them and get stuck in for the long term. So let's talk about this year, Matt. So we haven't really got time to go into a microscopic detail of the training. I would say that we returned to a format that we knew, not basing it really around your working conditions. And of course you'd moved jobs, so you had a bit more commuting to do now, and you'd been promoted, so you had a bit more responsibility. You're able to delegate, but that's, you still have the responsibility of the buck stopping at your door. And we also had to keep in the background this thing that was still hanging over you, is that you do have a heart problem. It's not like replacing a part on a car. You've had a heart problem. It's still there in the background, and we have to manage that, and we can't be cavalier with the amount of training we do or the intensity or the recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. So, without too much detail, I mean, the year 2018 sort of started in our trial separation period, if you like, in October of 2017. But really started to fire up in the early part of the year, and obviously a trip to Lanzarote, et cetera. But as you say, the heart condition in the background was always making me nervous. So a lot of the time, you know, we were certainly keeping it a little bit steadier, thinking more about the recovery and the rest. And as you say, the driving to and from my place of work was adding quite a considerable amount of time. So I had to spend more time thinking about getting the rest in, because, you know, they were long days. I was on work, if you like, for the usual 8 to 9 hours a day, plus another 2 to 3 hours worth of commuting.
Yeah, if I look at your, because we use Training Peaks, and for those who haven't picked up on this yet, you and I live a couple of hundred miles apart, so we get to see each other infrequently. We talk every week. If I can add in some of the little details that I think have made a difference, and you can tell me if they have made a difference, is for me, you've been much more focused this year with attention to detail. In the past, perhaps those weekly phone calls might have got missed, but you've made sure that you've hit the weekly phone calls to just catch up on stuff and run over any little details. You've showed much more attention to detail in terms of logging training and putting more detail into Training Peaks. And it's sort of like, from a distance, a coach can tell about the level of engagement of an athlete and motivation from the speed with which data gets uploaded, the detail of the comments that are going, and the engagement during phone calls. And I think those little things actually make a big difference.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the whole purpose in my mind of there's many reasons to have a coach. And number one is a level of accountability. But as you know, from years gone by, you know, I was being coached by you, but sometimes I'd miss sessions, et cetera. What was the worst thing you could do? I would get a slap on the wrist. But I think the difference is this year I was very accountable, not only with yourself, but I was hugely accountable to myself as well, because I've had that, you've only got so much time left. So the effort that went in this year versus the year before, whilst it didn't feel, on reflection, it didn't feel like a lot, you know, that extra 5% of making sure those sessions got logged, of making sure those phone calls happened, of finding the time to make sure I didn't miss that session, you know, that extra 5% was the bit that made all the difference in my mind.
Yeah, no, I agree, absolutely. And if I look at your Training Peaks diary, which you were very diligent at keeping, there are some significant points in all of this. You've definitely not been one of those athletes who has completed high volumes of training in the lead up to Ironman Wales this year. I think that your average training was probably, the training volume was 11 hours per week over the sort of 9 months leading up to Ironman Wales, which isn't huge by the standards of some people, but you were very consistent. You hardly missed any training. There was a definite constant line moving up in your fitness growth and development over the year. There were some significant bumps. You mentioned the Lanzarote camp that you had in March, which bumped up your fitness a bit. You also had a trip to Canada for 3 weeks where you were able to train without any worries. But there's been a steady line up there. And I can't remember any real blocks of training where you would have missed anything that wasn't planned in already. So you've not been ill. And another thing for me is that you've not been injured this year. I mean, you've always been a resilient athlete, but you have had little injury concerns in the past, haven't you?
Yeah. Funnily enough, at the moment, I've been sort of working to post Wales. I've got a couple of things that are, you know, sort of bugging me at the moment. But actually, throughout the whole of 2018, I don't recall any particular major things that slowed me down. And I was actually going to mention, but you've got there before me, was you know, the lack of illness, you know, the diligence in hygiene and things like that to allow you to continue to train and not miss any significant blocks. And that was also another little thing, you know. Sounds a bit OCD, but Julie's very keen on keeping the hand sanitizer around, and I just started following her same principles.
Well, I think, again, for anybody that's listening who wants to follow in your footsteps and get that qualification slot for Hawaii, it's not just about the training. Most triathletes are very good about training. They're motivated, almost too motivated at times, and get carried away, which is another thing I think that we've not talked about with having a coach, is that perhaps as you, in your personal training experience, you have clients that you work with who need a bit of a kick up the ass at times. I don't think that's the same in my experience for triathletes. In fact, I think the coach is often holding a lead and stopping people running away too much and getting carried away with themselves. Let's take that camp in Lanzarote, for instance. You went with a group of guys who are highly motivated. There's another lad there that's qualified for Kona and racing in 2018. There was one guy who went a couple of years ago, and another guy who is really keen to get out there. And so four guys training together, pushing each other on, and 7 days in which to absolutely batter yourself. And it could have gone quite horribly wrong from that. But I think we had an agreement afterwards that there was a certain number of, you know, a certain group of numbers you needed to hit, and that afterwards it'd very definitely be a recovery week to enable you to absorb the training, but make sure you didn't push on and get ill.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, it's very easy to come off of a big block. And I think the biggest weakness for a lot of people is that recovery element. And I think we've done a lot better this year. I've started to understand that the recovering is a key part of the training. Said to you earlier, I'm very analytical, so I like to look at the numbers, and it's very difficult for me to watch numbers take a backwards turn. But I equally know that, 6-7 days later, despite the drop in a few of these numbers, the way the body responds and the sessions you have afterwards, improve tenfold. So it's that bit of trust. And that's exactly what you say about the coach is, you know, sometimes scaling back the expectation of the athlete and saying, no, it'll be all right. Just take a little bit of time. And it's taken me 12 years to learn that. I won't lie. I'm still guilty even today of thinking, oh, maybe just a bit more, maybe just a bit more. It's in our mindset, but it's not the right mindset.
No. So the key lessons for me there are, it's not about how much volume you do. It's about what you do during that time. It's also about balancing the volume and the training with the amount of recovery you're able to get. And, you know, in your particular situation, your lifestyle, your family life, work life, you can get 10 to 12 hours of training in regularly, but any more than that would then cut into your recovery time. And so it would start to have a negative impact. And in order to support that training, it's about the other things, the other bits that we often ignore, the small elements like, you know, washing your hands, that hygiene to avoid picking up germs, particularly when you've got little children around that are going to school and mixing with other kids who've got germs and, you know, bringing them back into the house. Working in an environment, in a health club where it's actually probably not that healthy and there are people there with germs, trying to do your training and all of those little bits, plus the attention to detail with the training, the communication, the sleep and everything else. But we talked about you going to Canada. On returning from Canada, you were in the best shape you've ever been in. But you still had some little wobbles. You mentioned that right at the very beginning that you'd had a few little wobbles in the once you come back from Canada, you had a couple of weeks before Ironman Wales. So let's just talk about the running to Wales and then just executing the plan on the day. What were the things that were on your mind when you got back to the UK at the end of August?
I had about a 10-day gap between returning, possibly slightly longer, and going to Temby, in which time, you know, obviously we were going through that taper period. And, there was a couple of things that were going on. We talk about the coach relationship. You know, I was trying to maintain fitness and improve freshness, and I was trying to hold on to as much as I could. And you were trying to keep me, you know, for the expression, you were trying to keep me grounded. So that was a challenge. You know, I was starting to get those little niggles of doubt that maybe if I lost too much, I wouldn't be there on the day, and I needed to hold on to it as best as I could because I was in great shape. And then, you know, then there was this overwhelming feeling of expectation that I sort of started placing upon myself that we talk about the last year. I mean, from a physical, emotional, financial aspect, I've thrown everything I could at this year. The key to my best races have been consistency. 2016, 2016, 2012, you know, was being consistent, and I'd never put so much into a year. So for me to think that I'd done all this investment and then not get a return on investment potentially was starting to cause me to have a mini meltdown. And we talked about, you know, what would happen if I didn't get there, and you know, and I started almost I suppose I started destroying myself internally, you know, in a mental aspect. And I think, you know, at the time, you know, our conversation was based around, you know, is it the be all and end all? And whilst it sort of was, at the same time, you know, we, you know, took the mindset that actually, you know, you couldn't have done any more. And I really truly felt that about this year, you know, that I couldn't have done any more. And if I couldn't do any more, and it didn't happen on the day because of factors outside of my control. And it's always felt like that the uncontrollables have caused me to miss, that, you know, that was fine and that was okay. And I got comfortable with that in the 3 days before the race. I got really comfortable with that was okay. So much so that I think it was a howling gale the day before the race and you had me down for a short brick. And I sent you a text saying, I'm not going out there. This is the time when people fall off bikes or, you know, injure themselves on rocks in the sea or whatever. And I said, I don't need to do that. But some others will have done. They'd have just braved it and gone, well, I'm an Ironman. I'm going to get out there. I need to do this temp or this short brick session before my race. But I, you know, I was totally comfortable at that stage. Really, really at ease.
And so it came to pass that on, what was it, 13th of September?
It was 9th of September.
Yes, firmly ingrained on your mind. 9th of September, you've talked about the race. You talked about the swim and getting it right on the bike and running with those guys on the run. At what point in that race, on that run, did you know that you had it in the bag? Or did you not know? I mean, you obviously didn't know for sure until the Monday morning. But at what point did you think, I've got this now?
Yeah. It's a moment I've dreamed about and one that when it came to pass didn't feel at all like I thought it would be. So I'd been running in third place then for about 20 miles and I'd been seeing this. There's a chap who was a Belgian guy just you know, he's about a minute back and we'd been maintaining those splits, but I'd gone through a bad patch and I think mile 22 he caught me. And I knew I was in fourth place then with just the downhill from the top of the hill to go. I latched onto that chap and went back. And again, talking about the Wales course, before you get into town, you've got to do this really nasty along near the beach. I can't remember the name of the road. You've got to do this nasty kind of out and back before you actually hit the ups and downs of the town. And that's where Julie was. And she told me at about that point, I'm guessing it's about 3K-ish from the finish line. I knew I was in fourth. And she just said to me, he's miles behind you. Fifth is miles behind you. And that's when I sort of went, I think I've got this. I don't need to fall over on the downhills. I don't need to, you know, to trip up or twist an ankle. I think I've got this. And that was the moment where I thought, yeah, I think it's enough. But even then, you still don't believe it's going to happen. You want to see the roll down slots the next day, or you want to see the slot allocation because you just never know how many slots are going to be there, right?
Well, yeah, I spoke to our friend Colin from Race Skin, one of our supporters, and he was down there, and his assistant Rachel had said, "Yeah, there's 10 slots. Matt's fine. You know, he's qualified." And I wrote back to Colin saying, "Are you absolutely certain about that? I didn't want to share that with you in case I was wrong, and you suddenly got let down again." So I kept it to myself. And actually, what had happened was Rachel had looked at last year's slot allocation, which was 10 slots, so it was wrong. Just tell last thing then, talk us through Monday morning. You go along, you probably found the results already, which then said instead of unconfirmed but confirmed, and you're there in fourth place, and you go along to the presentation. It's out of town, isn't it, on an old airfield, and you're in a big marquee, and all of a sudden Joanne Murphy calls out your name. What was that feeling like?
Well, it's funny because obviously I'd known at that point that there were five spots and I was in four, so I knew I was going up. There was none of this roll down palaver, and it was like waiting for Christmas. And they started with the oldest age groups first, and the conversation, you know, and the cool down. And I was saying to Julie, I said, I don't know how I'm going to react. You know, what am I going to do? I knew I had to stand up. I had a good friend of mine, Phil, who you know as well, who's been, you know, texting me, you know, with big capital letters going, you know, will you take your slot? And I'm thinking to myself, how am I going to say this? And actually it was sort of organic on the day. I've got a video of it that, you know, she didn't even manage to get through the fourth place goes to Matt. And literally as my first name's out, I've jumped out the seat. My arms are in the air. I'm too sore to run, but, you know, I waddle my way quickly as fast as I can up to the stage. And, yeah, that was, you know, that, that's, that receiving of the lei and the cone of beer and the coin, etc., was I've had children, I've got married, you know, I've been the benefactor of great promotions. That is probably right up there in life experiences. It's been something I've worked so hard for. So yeah, it was a great experience. Great experience.
Wow, fantastic. And you know, amazing for me as a coach to see that and to have obviously been with you on all of that journey and seen the trials, obstacles, hurdles, issues that you've overcome, all of the time having this dream and you know, in situations where a lot of people might have thought, do you know what, I've got this heart problem, perhaps I'm just going to, you know, participate and enjoy the rest of my life and be healthy. But you haven't. And I think it just goes to show that if you do want to get to Kona, there is no easy way there. You know, even if you get a legacy spot, you've still got to go and do 12, at least 12 Ironman races. And so that takes time. You know, you've got to repeat that performance 12 times. So there's no easy route, and it requires a lot more than just physical talent and physical application, which is what you've demonstrated. And hopefully for those people who have listened to this story and who have the same dream, it will give you hope that if you keep at it and you have the right guidance and you're able to be hang tough mentally, you too can achieve that goal. It's almost an embodiment of that Ironman phrase, isn't it? Anything is possible.
Yeah. I was going to say, in summation, really, you know, it is a dream. It's one that, you know, that we've all got, I'm sure, out there. And people say, I see it on social media all the time. I'm never going to make it. But you know what? Amazing things do happen. And you know, I won't lie. You know, the amount of sacrifice that you sometimes have to put out, you know, is phenomenal. But if you've got a strong enough dream and a desire to make it, then yeah, absolutely. I suppose you can say anything is possible. And I don't want to sound cheesy when I say that, but you know, it has taken a long time. It didn't come easy, that's for sure.
Well, that's a fantastic story, Matt. So thank you so much for joining us, Matt, and sharing that with us. And I guess that our next podcast, when you return, probably in the middle of 2019, we'll talk about your preparations for Kona and how that's all going and what your ambitions are for racing on the Big Island. But for now, listeners, that was Matt Lawrence. Do you have anything final to say, Matt, before departing?
No, just say thank you very much. Say you've been part of that journey as well, and you know, we shared that glory together. And there's many more people out there that, you know, obviously I think needed to be thanked. Not least my friends and family. You know, the guys who I go to Lanzarote with. You know, we've got a good training group there. Julie's obviously my biggest supporter. And you know, I think don't forget the people around you. Really, you know, it's a singular journey. It's a very lonely journey, but there are a lot of people that are in your camp, and you know, take time out to reflect and thank them sometimes. So yeah, if they get a chance to hear this, then thank you guys. I really appreciate everything you've done this year. You
wow.
too, Simon.
Wow, you've been practicing for the Oscars.
Not quite, but it'll do.
Yeah. So listeners, if you may have questions, Matt and I haven't covered everything by a long way, but you know, we've still been at it for over an hour now. If you've got questions, feel free to post them on my Facebook page, and maybe Matt and I can come back and do a Q&A and answer those specifically. There will be some show notes, and so if Matt's agreeable, maybe we can put his contact details on there so you can have some private chats with him. For now, thank you for taking the time to listen. As always, I appreciate you being here. There are lots of podcasts I know that you could choose from to listen to, so I'm appreciative of the fact that you keep coming back week after week to listen to this one. I'll be back in a week's time with another fantastic guest, but from me and from Matt Lawrence, thank you for being here. Enjoy the rest of your week. That wraps up this week's episode. I'd just like to say thank you for taking the time to listen to the conversation today, and I hope you learned at least one thing that you can put into practice in your training. Now, if this was your first time listening, please go back and listen to our previous episodes. I can guarantee that they will be just as good as you heard from today's guest. If you've listened to all the episodes so far, then thank you so much for continuing this learning journey with me. As you might be aware, reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so I would really appreciate it if you could leave a review and a rating on iTunes or Podbean. You could also follow me at the same time. I also have a free gift for you. In 30 years of competing in triathlon, 20 years of coaching,
I've learned an awful lot from my own experiences and from some of the guests who have and will appear on this show. And I feel it's my duty, as I approach the latter stage of my coaching career, to share these with you. So I've put together 25 of my best training, racing and lifestyle strategies, and I've squeezed them down into just 2 pages of content. And in order to get hold of this, all you need to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send it right back out to you. You could also think about joining my Facebook community. It's called the Triathlon Coach Cafe. We've got over 2,300 members just like you, eager to find out more about how to improve their training and share their successes with people. It's free to join, but you will have to ask. So go along there, answer the questions, and then we'll even do a little video each week to answer your questions. Finally, if you want to make sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe using Podbean or iTunes. We release new episodes every Wednesday. So that's all for now. See you again next week, same time, same place.